Hello, my name's Nick Foster, and I'm the author of Could, Should, Might, Don't, How We Think About the Future. I've spent the last 25 years working within companies at the very forefront of emerging technology, from Google and Sony to Nokia and Dyson, and most recently I was head of design at Google X, where I led a brilliant team of designers, researchers and prototypers working on all sorts of nascent technologies, including brain-controlled computers, intelligent robotics, stratospheric internet balloons and neighbourhood-scale nuclear fusion. This book is about the future, but one thing I want to make clear is that this isn't a business book which is built around some sort of method. It isn't attempting to sell you a framework or a set of takeaways. I think there's millions of those books to pick from, and if you're anything like me, I'm guessing you're rather tired of them. What I'm trying to do with this book is to start a new conversation. A conversation about the future, yes, but not a conversation about what the future will hold. I don't want to make predictions or projections or even talk about the what of the future. I'm interested in opening up a conversation about how we think about the future. So, what's the point of this book? Well, thinking about the future appears to be more important now than ever. There seems to be a palpable sense of curiosity, uncertainty, and anxiety about the future, and Google searches for what will the future be like have tripled since 2020. I think that's because we've experienced more change in the last 100 years than at any other time in history. 100 years ago, we hadn't invented penicillin, and less than half the homes in America had electricity. My father, who lives in the UK, has experienced both a world before the creation of vinyl albums and after the creation of ChatGPT. Even if I think about myself, there were half as many people on Earth when I was born than there are today. It feels like all this rapid change has come with baggage, and many of the things we're trying to address today are the result of insufficient thought about the future from previous generations. I think this needs to change. And we need to have this conversation about our ability to think about the future. I'm a designer, and I see the world through designerly eyes, but I've been around entrepreneurs, scientists, engineers, strategists, investors, business leaders, and policymakers for my whole career. And it seems that no one is very good at thinking about the future. It feels like this is a skill which is significantly under-prioritized, underfunded, and underdeveloped in almost all of us. So what I've done with this book is to take a look at the ways in which we think about the future and try to create some sort of taxonomy to break it up into smaller, more digestible chunks. These all overlap, of course, and you should think about them more as caricatures, but what I've found in exploring the subject is that our thinking about the future tends to fall into one of four main varieties, which I've called could, should, might, and don't. So let's dig into those one by one. Could futurism is a way of thinking about the future with wide-eyed optimism and opportunity. This is probably the most familiar and publicly embraced type of futurism, and if you type futuristic into Google Images, this is the kind of thing you'll see. You know the stuff, the overly ambitious, excitable, over-the-top visions of flying cars, humanoid robots, and towering glass architecture. It's the kind of stuff you see from futurists on your conference stages or when futurists are invited onto TV. And this is also how we typically experience the future when we go to things like world's fairs or trade shows or expos. It's very technocratic. It's built around this modernist idea of growth and change through sort of strident progress, mechanization and industrialism. In truth, of course, this way of thinking about the future has largely grown in parallel with the growth of science fiction, which has fed back into the minds of many of our most powerful leaders and into the boardrooms of most of our powerful companies. It's exciting and it's escapist and it's intended to shock and widen the eyes, which can be incredibly powerful. It can motivate people and get them very excited about what might be ahead. But could futurism also has a lot of weaknesses, which are often overlooked. Just like sci-fi storytelling, this kind of futurism is incredibly heroic. It treats the future as a world filled with extreme characters having extreme experiences in extreme places, and often treads a little bit closer to advertising than truth. It also encourages us to think of the future as being a place of extreme transformation, but doesn't really embrace or even talk about any notions of transition or interstitial change. While it prides itself on its imagination, could futurism is also incredibly repetitive, as we can see whenever we do that search in Google for the future. What this actually represents is a placeholder for genuinely deep thinking, these sort of simplified icons of the future which we can drop into our slideshows and into our conversations, and actually replace genuine, deep, rigorous consideration. You see this a lot in corporate settings where people will happily drop references to the Jetsons, Minority Report or The Matrix, rather than do the real thinking themselves. So that's the first variety of futures thinking, could. The second way of thinking about the future is what I call should futurism, and this is focused on finding some sort of certainty and assuredness in the future. In the olden times, this was mostly built around things like soothsaying and predictions and people like Nostradamus or cutting open the belly of a goat and seeing the shape of the entrails that fell out. It's quite useful, actually. It can help us narrow down the future and just concentrate on focusing on one dot that lies somewhere out in the distance. In contemporary society, the world of should futurism is mostly dominated by what we call corporate strategy, the kind of work you see from people like McKinsey and Bain and BCG. This idea that we can somehow take data from the past, convert that solid line into a dotted line and have it point at a position in the future gives us something to aim at. It can be really useful. But I think the downfall of this way of thinking is that essentially what we're creating is pieces of well-styled, well-executed numeric fiction. Those dotted lines on charts are not real facts. Once the solid line converts to a dotted line, it ceases to be data and becomes a story. You'll often find people in the world of should futurism making bold predictions or statements about things that are definitely going to happen. They love that quote from Wayne Gretzky, which is about skating to where the puck will be. But as I mentioned, knowing where the puck will be is essentially a story. The problem of this type of thinking is that it tends to make us think of the world as some sort of system that can be decoded, converted into an algorithm, and then used to create simulations. But anybody that's put any money in the stock market knows that the dot in the future or the dotted line heading out into the future is just a story. But our world is more volatile, stochastic, and ultimately unmappable. And that idea of using historical patterns to project futures is remarkably unreliable. To use an acronym from the army, our world is VUCA, is volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. The third way of thinking about the future is what I call might, which basically comes from, if you've ever played chess, for example, it comes from the idea of plotting multiple scenarios out into the future, multiple if-this-then-that decision trees. This is sort of embedded in all of us whenever we're planning an event or trying to think of sort of eventualities that might happen. But it became more formalized around the Cold War with organizations like RAND and people like Herman Kahn. It was also grown upon by people like Pierre Vac, who worked for Royal Dutch Shell trying to run scenarios for their future business out into the distance. In today's world, this is referred to mostly by the term strategic foresight, and it's probably one of our most popular modern forms of futurism. And it has an awful lot of methodologies and matrices and diagrams and techniques and ways of thinking about the future as a series of decisions and decision trees. The problem with this way of thinking about the future is it can get tangled up in this academia. It's very jargon-filled and diagrammatic, and it uses lots of these methods and models and frameworks and techniques. And actually, it never really gives us an answer, just an ever-increasing list of potential outcomes. The second reason I have a problem with might futurism is it's not very good at imagining things. None of us are, really. We often think that certain things are ridiculous or unlikely, but just look at companies like Blockbuster and Nokia and Kodak, who didn't see things happening in their future, or if they did see them, completely put them out into the realms of unlikely or impossible. That's how our brains work. That's why when we watch things like magic and illusions, they fill us with wonder, because we've not seen those things before. So imagining what might happen in the future and building a sufficiently broad number of scenarios is a very difficult thing to do indeed. The final form of futurism that I've identified is what I call don't futurism, and this is focused on what might go wrong, or the things that we don't want to do, things that we might refer to as dystopian, for example. And fear is an incredibly potent storytelling technique in thinking about the future. That's why our fairy tales and our nursery rhymes often focus on what might go wrong if we choose the wrong path. It's also what we see in oppositional democratic politics, where you have a position of power and a party that's in opposition, who are there to point out all of the mistakes that might happen if we follow the rules of what's been put in place by the leading power. It's also found at the centre of things like protests and calls to stop things in the present. There's a more nuanced form of don't futurism appearing too, which is focused more on thinking through the externalities and implications of the things that we're bringing about in the world. Thinking at longer length about what happens then and then what. Thinking about products and services and technologies as they age and become embedded in our society. The problems with don't futurism are numerous. Typically that they force us into oppositional, divided factions of goodies and baddies. They're often polemic and call for immediate and often impossible action. They often don't integrate well with the people or industries they want to change either. Don't futurism is difficult because it often wants to be. And finding a balance between strong-willed don't ideas and actionable change can often be very difficult. So that's a quick dive into each of the four corners of the future map. What I hope to do with this book is to start a conversation about how we all think about the future, but more importantly, to help everyone become a better equipped critic of the futures they are shown or sold. I want to acknowledge the importance of cultivating long-term thought in everything we all do. And I want to acknowledge also our weaknesses across every aspect of society, culture, and business, so that that drives all of our futurists to do much better. So that's Could, Should, Might, Don't, How We Think About the Future. My name's Nick Foster. I hope you enjoy reading it.